It's Louisiana Considered. I'm Bob Pavlovich. Just ahead, we'll check on the safety of Mississippi River bridges in light of the Baltimore Francis Scott Key Bridge collision. And there's more to the pending settlement between home sellers and the National Association of Realtors than negotiable commissions. One real estate analyst helps us understand what's at stake. But first, it's Thursday, and it's time to catch up on politics with the Times-Picayune, The Advocate's editorial director and columnist, Stephanie Grace. Thanks for being here, Steph.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we're a few weeks into this legislative session in Baton Rouge, and it's shaping up to be consequential, isn't it?
Well, I can say that again. Regular sessions are always busy, but this one is something else entirely. It's, you know, it's like we're drinking from a fire hose. So mm-hmm. much is going on. Mm-hmm. There are so many major proposals that would result in really big policy and structural changes that it's almost hard to give each individual story its due. I've heard other people say this, and in my head, I'm calling it the kind of everything, everywhere, all at once session.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is this just because it's a new governor or the right new governor?
A combination. Mm-hmm. And also, I think it's the legislature. It's true that Jeff Landry is really intent on disruption, and he's clearly calculated that he'll never have more power and influence than he does right now at
That's
the beginning
right.
of his term
mm-hmm.
after having won a big victory. And he's probably right about that. And because he's so powerful now, other politicians are really falling in line, even when they privately, sometimes publicly express doubts about some of the things he wants to do. Most of them just don't want to cross him. You know, but it's also this legislature, which is not only supermajority Republican, but just really, really conservative. So there are big agenda items on the table, including a number that didn't make the cut when Democrat John Bel Edwards was governor, but that have support from the governor's mansion now. And I have to add that there's an obvious strategy here. By doing so much so quickly, it really keeps the opposition or even people who just have concerns from getting organized and gathering momentum and kind of getting themselves really heard. It really keeps all the issues from being fully aired in public. And again, that really does seem to be by design.
Couldn't that be a two-edged sword, though? Let's get all these things in quickly now so there's no opposition. And then a year or so down the line, you discover that it wasn't the greatest right idea or the budget can't support it?
Sure. I think that's true. I think we saw that with Bobby Jindal, frankly. You know, he came in and there was a big surplus after Katrina and they made huge tax cuts and then reality hit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that could happen here too. But, you know, the problem is once things are already in law, it's hard to reverse them.
Can you walk us through some of the major changes on the table?
I can try. Like I said, there are so many. On education, there's a proposal to greatly expand the use of public money for private schools.
Mm-hmm.
That's moving through the system, through the process. You know, how much it would cost is a point of heated debate right now. On insurance, lawmakers look like they want to weaken a number of consumer protections, hoping that this will attract more insurers into the market, bring competition, and eventually lower these sky-high property insurance prices that everyone's facing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big gamble, but it's what the new insurance commissioner, Tim Temple, wants to try. And among the bills that seem to have some support is one to water down Louisiana's really popular three-year rule. It's a unique rule. No other state does it, but it bans insurers from dropping policyholders who've been with a company for at least 3 years under most circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, elsewhere, based on the task force report that came out this week, it looks like we're about to debate at least a temporary state takeover of the New Orleans Sewage and Water Board. Perhaps a long-term shift of control from the mayor to the city council or the state public service commission. But that's a big fight that's brewing.
Mm-hmm.
And that would have to happen in the legislative session. And lawmakers are also moving a big severance tax cut for oil and gas ahead of the temporary sales tax expiring next year. See what I said about Bobby Jindal.
Mm-hmm.
And much more. They're talking about rewriting the state constitution like this summer in just a couple weeks.
As you mentioned, there's some proposals that we've seen before, but that seem to be getting more friendlier listenings and hearings right now.
Yeah. I mean, one such bill would bar people from approaching an active crime scene. and critics' fear can be abused and even keep people from recording police doing their job, which we know has been an important development in recent years. A similar bill made it through the legislature last year, but John Bel Edwards vetoed it. There are various bills to crack down on discussion of gender identity in schools. Edwards opposed these as unnecessary and mean-spirited, but Landry supports them in the name of parental control. There is a bill to ban vaccine mandates in schools, also in the name of parental control. And here's an oldie but goodie, some will remember. I remember. We're talking about eliminating the mandate that motorcyclists wear helmets again. Oh yeah, people with long memories might remember that we did that in 1999 at the behest of then Governor Mike Foster, who was an avid biker himself. This was a personal issue for him. But the mandate was reinstated sooner after he left office, at the urging of public health experts and, kind of highway safety experts. Deaths went up during that period. They were able to document that. Nevertheless, a bill has passed the House to lift the mandate again, as long as riders are over 21 and have $100,000 insurance and agree not to sue anybody for damages involving head injuries. It's being pushed in the name of freedom, which is a word we're hearing a lot these days out of Baton Rouge. But, the public health and safety concerns remain, as well as cost concerns.
The Times-Picayune, The Advocate's editorial director and columnist, Stephanie Grace. Thanks for being here, Steph.
Thank you.
From WWNO in New Orleans and WRKF in Baton Rouge, you're listening to Louisiana Considered. I'm Bob Pavlovich. More than 10,000 cargo ships sail through the port of New Orleans each year. It's one of the country's largest. So how does the port ensure the safety of the Crescent City Connection Bridge and the other major infrastructure along the Mississippi River? It's a question on the minds of many residents after a ship crashed into the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore earlier this week. We reached out to Sabharathanam Kameshvar, professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at LSU, and he's here to speak with us. Thanks for being here, Kameshvar.
Yep, happy to be here.
First, how similar are Louisiana's ports to the one in Baltimore where the accident took place?
I think they are very different in nature, in my opinion. The Port of New Orleans handles a lot of grain shipment coming down the Mississippi, so there's a lot of barge traffic as opposed to container ships. Of course, we have container ships as well, but I think our mix has a lot more barges in addition to the container ships that we have. Baltimore is more container ships and so on, and bigger ships of that kind.
More ocean-going vessels, in that I mean
Yeah.
a greater number of them coming right out
Mm-hmm.
of the Atlantic. How about our bridges? Are they similar in height and design?
The bridges, they're similar in the sense that they're taller than an average bridge that you might cross on a river, just so that the big ships can pass underneath the bridge. So I don't know the exact age of our bridges that we have. I know the one in Baton Rouge over the Mississippi is about 50 some years older, like old. So they have similarities in the design in the sense that they were built using the same design code. So, and back in the day, we had codes and requirements for how much they have to design for considering a ship or a barge hitting a bridge. So they had to consider those aspects. And in that sense, they're similar. But beside that, the height, length, and all of those things change, and that changes the strength and the size of the bridges as well. So they're similar in the sense that they have common design guidelines behind them.
Has the accident in Baltimore impacted ship traffic in and out of the Mississippi at all?
I don't know the exact answer to that, to be fair, because this is beyond my expertise. But I think it should not affect ship traffic in our area. As I said, mainly because our traffic is a lot of barges.
Mm-hmm.
If a barge hits a bridge, the story is completely different than a big ship like we had seen, the Neo Panamax Bridge. It's a completely different scenario. And for us, as we go up the river, the percentage of these Panamax ships is much smaller than it was in the Baltimore case. So it's a different case. I'm not worried for our operations at this time.
Have we ever had a similar accident?
I think we had a container ship, not a container, it was a oil container ship hit the Sunshine Bridge in the past couple of years. I think there was one incident like this. So there were some concerns about the safety of the Sunshine Bridge, but I think the bridges, the DOTD inspected the bridge and they had made the repairs, and I think the safety should not be an issue of that bridge at this time.
What safety systems do we have in place to prevent similar catastrophes on the Mississippi?
So if any bridge on a navigable waterway, like a river like we have Mississippi, or in a portway, things like that. So we have fenders. So I'm just simplifying it. So it's basically, it's like fenders, but they're huge. They are there to prevent such kind of accidents where a barge or a ship comes and hits the bridge piers. So we have those in place. Every bridge like that has those in place. But in this case, for the Baltimore Bridge, it never stood a chance. The ship was so big that the fender had no chance of protecting that bridge. In our case, we have the fenders as well to protect our bridges, and that's the standard practice everywhere in the country and world over to protect bridges from impacts like these.
We're speaking with Sabarathinam Kameshvar, professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at LSU, about the safety in the Port of New Orleans in the aftermath of this week's accident in Baltimore. Could we be doing more to protect our bridges?
I mean, yes, of course, that the answer will always be yes, but it's just how much money can we spend doing that? So I think at this point we have improved design guidelines. So if this bridge was built today, or the new bridge, whichever is going to be built now, will probably be safe. Safe in the sense that it will not let people die. Like, unfortunately, we had several people die in that accident. That would not happen. The bridge may be just, not usable anymore, but it would not collapse and let people die. So that is the difference that we would have with the new design codes versus what we had 50 years and older design codes. So the design codes are improving to sustain bigger hits on the bridges. So that is something that we are doing. And again, we can make them foolproof or we can make them fail-safe. But again, how much money do we want to invest is the question. That's where the benefit comes in, cost-benefit analysis. And also we are tracking better data on how many ships are crossing, what are the rates of accidents, because it's kind of balanced between how frequent are these things versus how much money do we spend on this in case such a thing happens, right? So we're getting better data on that, especially on the Mississippi. We have much better data on that than we had before. And also there's more data on what causes these accidents in the first place. A lot of times it's bad weather because the pilot cannot see the bridge piers and things like that, and the navigational guides that they have. So we have better data. That's one thing that we can do more of is to get better data to understand how to design bridges safer in the future.
I know the traveling public's always ears always perk up when they hear a story like this. What about the safety for them? Is there anything we could improve that would bring gates down and close off the bridge if someone gets a mayday call from a ship that's out of control?
I think it's like, it's not a complete black swan, but this is something unprecedented that the whole bridge collapsed. We had similar incidents before in the past where a particular part of a bridge collapsed when a barge came and hit a bridge and things like that have happened, but never like this when the entire bridge collapsed altogether. So maybe I think we would need to have some kind of protocol like that to close down a bridge when we have a mayday call saying, hey, we are out of control, we don't know what's going to happen. So I think that might be a good idea in the future. And we need to do more in terms of what can be done to avoid that in the first place. If a ship, I cannot imagine a ship like this not having a fail-safe of steering and other mechanisms to avoid such kind of a collision in the first place.
What does the accident say about the potential changes that should be made?
To
structures in the bridges, to the cargo ships themselves and their operation?
I think we just have to be more careful with the operation. I think that is the key part, because the bridges, as I said earlier, the design codes have been improving steadily, and of course they will improve in the future as well. So from a structural engineering perspective, the improvement is there, and we are designing it to be more safer. But I think operational wise, we have to be more careful about how to avoid these situations, like the idea you suggested, have some kind of a fail-safe where if there is a out of control ship, then we close down a bridge or have some other fail-safe mechanisms that people don't die at the end of the day. That's the most important aspect of this, that we should never have any accident where we have fatalities.
Sabarathinam Kameshvar is professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at LSU. Thanks for your time today.
Yeah, absolutely.
From WWNO in New Orleans and WRKF in Baton Rouge, you're listening to Louisiana Considered. I'm Bob Pavlovich. Changes are coming in buying and selling houses due to a recent class action settlement involving the National Association of Realtors and home sellers. And while the suit is settled, its effects are adding to an unsettled housing market. We have invited Arthur Sterbko, real estate analyst, to join us. Thanks for being here, Arthur.
My pleasure, Bob.
Before we talk about savings or costs for buyers and sellers, is this all settled? What do you see after the Ohio jury's decision?
Well, it's a strange decision because it is going to upset the apple cart of how real estate transactions have been held for decades. It's not settled yet, is a short answer to your question. The judge in May, who was the federal judge who oversaw the case, is going to make a decision on what the proposed settlement is. And also the Department of Justice will probably weigh in as to whether they agree with the settlement or not. So in May, we'll probably have better direction on what the judge finally decides and what probable paths realtors will have to take in order to complete real estate transactions for consumers.
And I assume that even if the judge takes their action in May, the Department of Justice may have something to say about this, right?
Yeah, there's a series of steps that are going to have to take place. Certainly, once the judge agrees to the settlement, certainly the DOJ will weigh in. And whether they agree with the settlement or disagree with the settlement, that's another whole conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But when the judge makes the decision in May, that's when the chaos really begins, because state real estate commissions in all 50 states will probably have to go and modify their contracts, their rules and regulations, and then boards of realtors, MLSs, the realtor associations will all have to modify their rules for ethics and how agents are allowed to interact with each other and offer compensation, if any. It's going to be a wild, wild rodeo from now until the end of the year.
The settlement specifically deals with sellers of houses. Is there another lawsuit on behalf of buyers?
There are plenty of lawsuits out there. There are many copycat lawsuits that are working their way around the country. This one will probably settle many of them. So yes, this one's affecting sellers, but there are also some lawsuits where the plaintiffs or the buyers suing realtors for failure to disclose or in their mind, collusion with the seller's agents to fix commissions. The business right now, the industry is pretty much going in the same direction it always has. I haven't seen anybody make any dramatic moves on a national basis. Some individual brokerages have made some changes in different marketplaces, but everyone is still kind of waiting to see because they're not sure that the changes they may make are going to be in accordance with what the judge may decide or the DOJ may decide. So we're going to see some new business models without a doubt after the judge's decision and after the DOJ weighs in.
Despite appearances and was alleged in the lawsuit, the commissions have never been set, have they? They've always been negotiable?
No, it's really interesting, Bob. Most people don't know this, but the very first Department of Justice lawsuit against realtors was McCain versus the Real Estate Board of New Orleans in 1977. New Orleans, the Real Estate Board of New Orleans at the time, was the poster child for fixing commissions. It was unbelievable. But back then, the listing agreements even said the commission shall be 6% as required by the Real Estate Board of New Orleans. That's when the very first lawsuit came to be in 1977, and it went to the United States Supreme Court. And that court decision said, yeah, you guys have violated the Antitrust Act. That led to the DOJ's constant involvement and supervision of the real estate industry ever since then. And they've been slowly and steadily trying to make changes in the real estate industry. And the courts have generally agreed with realtors throughout the process. There have been many, many lawsuits since 1977. This is the first one they lost, mm-hmm. which is what has really upset the apple cart. All of a sudden, this interpretation of the Antitrust Act, which was a bit of a stretch, but regardless, it's now the law of the land. If the judge approves the settlement, it'll move forward.
We're speaking with Arthur Sterbko, real estate analyst, about the recent settlement with the National Association of Realtors and buyers and home sellers. One of the solutions I've heard is people speculate how all this is going to shake out. It's going to be harder for buyers. Rolling commissions that have to be paid into a mortgage isn't possible right now. That's not allowed. Can that be changed, and who changes it?
Well, the lenders themselves, the underlying lenders, HUD, VA, they'll have to make some modifications in their lending. Otherwise, we really have some unknown issues. The seller is allowed under the proposed settlement to offer buyer concessions. Well, they've always been allowed to do that. I mean, that's just the seller will allow so much for a new carpet or towards a roof replacement. The seller can offer the buyer concessions, which could also include the buyer brokerage commission. They're just not allowed to advertise that in the MLS separate from seller concessions. The brokers are going to have to call and confirm this is the commission we're being offered on this transaction in order to get paid or have some rights to a commission if they introduce a buyer to the property. It's going to be confusing, and the agents are going to have a real learning curve.
Not every person who represents a property is a realtor. Is this going to affect everyone in the real estate industry?
Yes, without a doubt. The real difference between those who are realtors and those who are just real estate licensees and don't pay dues to NAR is simply that the realtors are strictly bound by a code of ethics, a specific arbitration process, a specific ethic process, and they have to abide by those rules. A regular real estate licensee is not bound by that.
So with all this movement, what's your advice for home sellers and buyers if they can't wait for all of this to shake out? They have to sell or buy a house now.
I continue to use their agent. A realtor is so valuable in transaction. Until this settlement is done, I think most real estate transactions, and they're being done daily, is being handled the exact same way. This settlement then will basically, I guess, exonerate any transactions. But in the meantime, in this gray area, I think most people are doing the exact same thing they've always done.
Arthur, if all this comes to pass, what do you see its effects being?
Well, I think you're going to see reduced commissions. You're going to see reduced numbers of agents in the market as they fail to adapt to the new marketplace. And probably the biggest worry I have is the impact on low-income and first-time home buyers. I think they will be very adversely affected, assuming these settlements go through. And the reason being, when commission rates go down, realtors, real estate licensees, they're just not going to make as much money selling someone a house that's $80,000 to $100,000 as they are $300,000. So are they really going to put their effort towards those first-time home buyers and low-income buyers? And they're the ones that require the most by a factor of 10, just about. They're very, very hard to get approved and having to work with the lenders because they've not had an experience with appraisers, inspections, and the entire home buying process. So it's a whole new learning curve. Those, you know, experienced buyers have bought and sold five or six houses. You know, many times it's filling out a contract. They found the house online. Not really a big problem. The agent simply, you know, I don't want to say go through the motions. There's still a lot of work that has to be done from the buyer side, but it's not nearly as intense. And the fall-through rate on those sales is very low relative to first-time home buyers. So it's going to be, I think, problematic for that part.
Real estate analyst Arthur Sterbko, thanks for being here.
My pleasure, Bob.
And if you've sold a home in the last 10 years, you can see who's covered by the settlement at the website realestatecommissionlitigation.com. And that's Louisiana Considered for today. Thanks to our guests, the Times-Picayune, The Advocate's editorial director and columnist, Stephanie Grace, Sabarathanam Kamishvar, professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at LSU, and real estate analyst Arthur Sterbko. Our managing producer is Alana Schreiber. Our contributing producers are Matt Bloom and Adam Voss. We receive production and technical assistance from Garrett Pittman and our assistant producer, Aubrey Procell. You can listen to Louisiana Considered Monday through Friday at noon and 7 p.m. on this station. It's also available on Spotify, Google Play, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Bob Pavlovich. Thanks for listening.
Major support for Louisiana Considered provided by Rouse's Markets, a Louisiana shopping experience. More at rouses.com with additional support from Southern Strategy Group.